1, and this is a wonderful day. Wow, the temperature is just perfect. Even Reno, right, wait a minute, where did I come from? Phoenix? I've been in Reno in a long time. But even Phoenix plunged down to 80 degrees today as a high. That's just amazing. Cold spell. But excitement is in the air with the feast upcoming. A couple of things here by way of announcements before we get into the message. Says, although the feast hasn't even started, it's time to talk about the post-feast party. The post-feast party will be Saturday night, November 1st at Abraham's house. Please bring your pictures, memories, food for a potluck dinner. See Jill if you have any questions. It might be nice to bring back some of the messages that particularly struck you, or a interesting lesson that you learned that you had, something you hadn't thought of before, or something that will help motivate you during the rest of the year, whatever it might be. Some of those things might be very helpful too. Remember, Atonement is this coming Thursday, 1 o'clock here, so come hungry. I have a note here from Jeanette that she wanted to pass on to all of you. Ask you to remember her for it. She said, the results of my recent stress test indicate a small abnormality in my heart. I'm going against the recommendation of the heart doctor, who wants to do more testing Monday. Instead, I've decided to wait until late October for the test. I feel no different than I did 6 months ago, but ask your prayers that God will heal me and protect me as I travel to Branson to keep his feast in the Ozarks. So the doctor kind of wanted to control her destiny, and she wasn't good with that. So she's trusting that God will see her through this time of difficulty. And I don't think she wants to have a discussion with everybody about all of the details, since it gets a little laborious going through it. But she did want her brothers and sisters to know about that, and please be praying for her. So remember Jeanette as she works her way towards the feast. I left my Bible. Bad thing for a preacher to leave his Bible. This is such an exciting time of year. We're right in the midst of the holy day season, for the fall holy days. And it's not just the holy day services and just the messages. It's not just the fellowship we have, the travel to the feasts, and all of those things, but what it pictures, that we are picturing the return of Jesus Christ to this world and him setting up his way of life for all of the pain and the sorrow and the tears and the fears to go away. But as we go through these holy days, as Trumpets particularly pictures, there's a time of difficulty before that occurs. A time of trial, a time of test, a lot of things going on. And there are a lot of prophecies the Bible talks about things that are bad that have to happen before the good comes. Now, if you've been around a short time, maybe you haven't had a lot of exposure to some of the prophecies that the Bible talks about regarding the end and what's to occur. If you've been around for a long time, like some of us have, for years we've talked about some of the things that must come to pass, and then the end shall come. And as I go back over the years that I've been attending since I was 10 years old, I've read these prophecies, I've internalized the Word of God about what's going to happen. But even when you believe it with all your heart that the Word of God is true and the things that Christ say are going to happen, it's hard to put ourselves into the picture of things being different than they are right now. And we all have a hard time imagining, even when we think about the future, when we think about even retirement, chances are we think of ourselves retired in about the same condition we are right now. Well, that's not going to be the case. We're going to be older, and we don't know what's going to happen in the meantime, whether it's physical things or what financial things or whatever circumstances might be that we'll run into. It's hard to imagine things actually taking place. One of the things that's difficult for us to imagine is the events to take place just before the return of Jesus Christ that talk about this country being substantially changed from what it is now, both militarily, economically, politically. It talks about captivity. It talks about all kinds of things that I think we find it really impossible to imagine it actually being like. One of those things is found in Revelation chapter 13. And I want to talk about that today, and the main focus is going to be a concept that we're all probably familiar with, at least in principle, and we've speculated about how things might occur, and we may be right on some of our speculation, we may be in error on some of our speculation, but nevertheless, here are some of the things that the Bible says are going to happen before we find the millennium coming to this earth, and then coming down from God out of heaven to have the new heavens and new earth later on. But chapter 13 of Revelation in verse 1, it says, I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and his horns 10 crowns, and his head a blasphemous name. And it's not my purpose today to go into and to explain who the beast power may be, the history and the origin and that type of thing. We'll just suffice it to say that we're talking in Revelation chapter 13 about a political system of power that is to be over the world, a religious system of power to be over the world, an economic system of power to be over the world. That's the essence of this, and again, I'm not trying to explain all of these things and the symbolism and all that type of thing. The verse 2 says, the beast I saw was like a leopard, his feet like a bear, and his mouth a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and his great authority. The dragon in the Bible is typical of Satan, showing that this is a system that Satan is running, he's operating, and he's the one behind it. And there are these people, here are these nations, here are these systems that are acting at the behest of Satan. And verse 4, and they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who's like the beast? Who's able to make war with him? A great war machine, military might, such as the world hasn't seen. There was worship involved, false worship. In other words, they're worshipping a false religious system, not keeping the commandments, as God says to keep, but a false religious system. And verse 5, and he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemes. He was given authority to continue for 42 months. So here's a 3-year period of time that he's ruling. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and the tabernacle and those who dwell in heaven. In verse 7, it was granted him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And so here's a prophecy that is speaking directly to you if you are a saint. The saints are described as those who have submitted themselves to God and have received the Holy Spirit and are part of the body of Christ. And so it's talking about a prophecy that would affect, hopefully will affect you and me in this perspective. Not because it's a good thing particularly, but because it shows with the saints. Okay, but it does, and it will affect us. And so it was granted to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe and tongue and nation. A great system, political, economic, religious. And verse 8, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So it says that God's people cannot be a part of this system because being a part of this system causes you to disobey God. It's like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they were told they had to worship the king and worship their gods. They refused, and they were thrown in the lion's den. In other words, they were going to be killed. Of course, God delivered them and into the fire and so forth. Verse 9, anyone who has an ear to hear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with a sword must be killed with a sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So there's a prophecy about us and about the entire world. And then it talks about another beast coming up, having authority and power. In verse 14, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast. And so there's a great religious deception. And verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the beast should both speak and cause many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And so, however it's set up, somehow it affects those who would worship God in the right way to be killed if they don't, or if they're not protected by God. We talked about the place of safety a couple of months ago, that there will be a group of saints that will be protected during this time. There will be others out there who will be converted during this period of time, who will be the saints, but will choose not to worship the beast or his image. In verse 16, he causes both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or in their foreheads. And so there's something, either literally or symbolically, that will identify you as a worshiper of the beast and the image of the beast. And what is the result of having this mark or not having this mark? It says, verse 17, that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And so buying or selling is involved with this. This whole process of there being a great nation, an army of nations, group of nations, and a great religious system and political system and war system is that you don't worship them, then you'll be killed. And it even says you won't be able to buy or sell unless you've got certain identity involved here. Verse 18, here's the wisdom. Let him who has understanding, calculate the number of the beast, the number of the man, and that number is 666. And of course, there are movies made about 666, and there are books, and there are all kinds of speculations about what this exactly is. I'm not going to reveal that to you today. I know, but I'm just not telling. No, I don't. I have no clue what 666 really means, or what the symbolism is, or what Roman numeral count out means a name, or thing or whatever, but again, let's just focus on this concept that there's no buying or selling without the authority of this power. It's an aspect. Now, we could talk about the religious aspect, we could talk about other aspects of it, but suffice it to say here that this is a system that is a very wealthy system. And the Bible says that that system has a lot to do with money and trade and financial power. Look at chapter 18 of Revelation. Chapter 18, verse 1, after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven having great authority. The earth was illuminated with his glory. Verse 2, and he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen. Is fallen, has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit and cage for every unclean and hated bird. But now notice verse 3, speaking of this system. It says, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I'm sure there's some symbolic meaning to this too, but it's literally having to do with the merchants of the earth, with wealth, and this system controlling whether people buy or sell. And it goes on. We're not going to read all of these scriptures, but when you read down here about this, verse 11, it says, "The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore." And then it talks about the merchandise of gold and silver and stones and pearls and linen and silk and scarlet. Then it goes on later to talk about the, verse 17, and an hour such, for in an hour such great riches come to nothing. Every shipmaster and all who travel by ship and sailors, many trade on the sea, stood at a distance. So it's talking about a great trading system. It's talking about the financial system of the whole world. So finances play a part in this process, a rather large part. Military plays a large part in the process. Religion plays a large part in the process. And they all do. But today I want to focus on the economic part of what's going to happen in the future. And again, thinking about how could it happen? How could there be one system worldwide to bring every other system under them? We have yet to see how that is all going to happen, but I expect we're all aware that there's some things happening in the economy right now that are a little bit concerning. In fact, for those that are paying attention, it's very concerning about what's going on. Now, let me preface anything else that I say with the scripture that God tells us, no one knows the day or the hour. Okay, so I'm not up here saying this is it, this is the final thing, but I am going to, I think, just by going over some of these things, show that this is a preface to that, that it's leading up to what we just talked about. And I think it'll show us that, yeah, this stuff can happen. And that we actually now are living in a time that shows how this can happen. How soon it is, nobody knows. It could be, you know, it could be in a very short period of time, or it could be 50 years. I don't know how things are going to go. You could go back into the literature of the Radio Church of God. Mr. Armstrong started that years ago, and then into Worldwide Church of God, and into United Church of God, and some of the others who have come out from that system. And you could read articles that are very similar to this back in the 30s and the 50s and the 60s. This particular article I'm going to give a few quotes from is from the Good News magazine in May-June of 1998. Remember, this was written in 1998, 10 years ago. And the title of it is Global Economy and Jesus Christ's Return, written by Roger Foster. And he mentions this beast system and no one buying or selling. And he says, in our society, which greatly values individual freedom, it seems almost absurd to predict such a drastic global change in economic outlook and practice. What could possibly induce citizens of civilized nations to accept such intrusive controls over their right to buy and sell as they please? As I was saying, it's hard for us to imagine how these things can happen. But this is sharpening our imagination here a little bit. He said, on a regional level, this scenario has already been played out once in this century. And then he talks about the Great Depression. And he talked about the rise of Hitler during the Great Depression. And people were turning to a great power to help them out of their economic disasters that they were going through. And these are things that he looks back on and says it kind of happened in the past. And he says the destructive effects, and he's talking about, well, the destructive effects of prolonged deflation are almost unimaginable to most. And the fact you and I haven't been through the Depression. I don't think anybody in here is old enough to have been through the Depression, certainly as an adult. And is anybody even, like, visible at the Depression in the 30s in here? I mean, some of us old folks, none of us are that old. I didn't think so. Not even me. But it says, consider the consequences. As wages drop, debt retirement becomes more and more difficult. Okay. You've got debts. You find it difficult to pay that debt because you don't have a job. Or your wage goes down. Mortgage defaults skyrocket. It's written in 98. Business earnings drop and corporations go bankrupt. Have any of that going on right now? Employment dries up. People become aimless and idle. Hunger and fear, their constant companions. It's a downward spiral into economic oblivion. Little wonder our parents and grandparents referred to the human disaster they experienced as the Great Depression. In times of such economic deprivation, people sometimes respond favorably to exceptionally strong, decisive leaders who show promise of quickly bringing order out of chaos. Drastic problems can lead to drastic solutions. And so he says, things going on cause us to change our perspective a little bit, causes us to accept stuff we wouldn't normally accept. What's going on in the debates right now? You've got Republicans who are basically, you know, against governmental control, saying, yeah, I guess you're right, we need more governmental control. The Democrats are saying, we told you all along we needed more government control. And so people are, you know, even the Republicans are saying, yeah, I guess you're right. You know, we do need the government to rescue us and to have more control over the wages and more control over the banks and more control over the whole system. People want immediate action, not principles and platitudes. I just think it's so amazing what's happened in the last 2 weeks and how this could be written like within the last 2 weeks. The leaders most likely to spur their followers to actions are those who have no objection to trampling on the rights of others to accomplish their own agendas, to get things done, but at an appalling cost to freedom and dignity. And then he says that's basically what happened with Adolf Hitler. As the people were willing to give things up, and they were pretty happy to have old Adolf there helping them out of their economic depression when they were going through that, but at what cost? I was forwarded an article a couple of weeks ago, well, a week ago, on from WorldNet Daily. Some of you read that. It's kind of a religious conservative daily program that is out there on various things. And this guy wrote an article that I think is quite interesting, and I want to take off from what we just read that Roger Foster wrote about drastic circumstances lead to some drastic changes. This is this guy's opinion, but it's interesting. He says, do you think it's an accident? Do you think it's just a case of bad management? Do you think the proposed $700 billion taxpayer bailout of the United States financial institutions just happened? He says, I don't think so. In fact, I think it's a part of a master plan, one pushing us inexorably closer to a closed, cashless, global economic system of total control. Now, what is Revelation 13 if not a economic system of total control? He says, I know this seems like an extreme statement. It sounds like I've drunk deep of the conspiracy Kool-Aid. Now, I want to be, me personally, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. Some of you may be. I haven't asked, but and that there's something behind every corner and everything happens and so forth. And they're a little bit to that. I'm not convinced that it's as much as conspiracy theorists believe, but he said, let's just look at some facts. Let's take a look at history. And I think this will give us a little history of how people adapt to changes, to show that from this point on, how easy it's going to be for us to adapt to other changes that can end up putting the world under an economics, a system of economic control. So he goes back into history a bit. He says, in the beginning, crops and livestock were the measure of a man's wealth. It wasn't always convenient or easy to trade or barter for other things people needed because of the need to capitalize quickly on a harvest or to offer goods and services far from home. So I got a cow. You know, you just raised a bunch of wheat. And so we'll meet part way. You take my cow, I'll gather your wheat. Now, if there's some crop that's a long ways away, by the time you walk your cow there, it walked off all its weight and it's not worth as much. So there's some difficulties in this barter system. It's not real easy to do. You know, if you can do my taxes and I've got a computer that you want, we could trade your taxes for my computer or whatever, but things become difficult. So people and nations developed systems of coinage, usually based on the intrinsic value of metals like gold and silver. So I've got this piece of gold here. And you know how valuable gold is. You can make rings out of it. You can do all kinds of stuff with gold. And so I won't bring my cow. I'll bring this gold, and I'll trade you for your wheat. And so people started using coins. Okay, a little change, but you think, well, does this make sense? I mean, I could have a cow, but actually I'm taking some gold. I mean, it's just a piece of metal. I can't eat it. You know, I can't reproduce it or anything like that. So it must have been difficult when that change started to come and they were changing coins instead of things. It's not as valuable. The system worked well for a long time, thousands of years, in fact. But large amounts of gold and silver were often difficult to move around. I got all this silver, but for me to haul all that silver over to you, man, I don't know, it just... a lot of time, a lot of effort. The bartering is a long ways away. When you start trading a little more broadly than just your neighborhood. So the gold and the coins and the silver thing, maybe something else needs to be done. So the idea of paper currency representing holdings of gold and silver was the next phase. Now imagine how difficult that was too. I've got this gold and... so now you're telling me that this paper you're giving me is worth as much as my gold. I don't think so. I mean, look at your paper, you can burn it, it could be gone, but you're telling me that's valuable. Well, eventually that took place. How many of you carry gold coins around with you? Everybody? Carry paper? Some of you. But not as much as that. Okay, whatever works. So, I'm sure it took a lot of persuading, he says, to convince people that their paper really had value. Yeah, right. You know, it's like one of these internet scams, you know, and says, well, you do this, well, you get that. You say, yeah, sure, and you push spam, you know, because you want to get rid of that. Well, this paper is actually worth something. But there again, we got used to it. I'm sure there was distrust at first, but again, it was more convenient, and people accepted it. One thing that makes it easier for governments to persuade people to accept monumental changes in the way they conduct commerce is a crisis. So Mr. Foster was saying is when there's some disaster, then things are easier to get used to something different. In the 1930s, we had such a crisis in America. There are still arguments today about what caused the Great Depression, whether it was part of a natural cycle, an accidental disaster, a conscious plot by greedy men, but it happened, and a few people profited greatly from it, as did government. In 1933, Franklin Roosevelt ordered the confiscation of most gold from private citizens. You got gold? Well, we're calling that in, but I'll give you some paper instead. How's that? Cool! I got this paper instead of my gold. This might be a tough sell to freedom-loving people in ordinary times, but these weren't ordinary times. America was in the midst of a crisis. Officials explained their currency would be backed by gold in Fort Knox, so people complied. Okay, anytime you need it, we've got it. It's no big deal. It's just in Fort Knox where it's safe, and so you can give me your paper and we'll give you your gold when you want it. Well, how long did that last? What resulted in the coming years through World War II was one of the largest expansions of government and government power in American history. Along with it, Americans lost much of their liberty. In 1971, President Richard Nixon announced the federal government would no longer redeem currency with silver. Now, I know some of you are old enough to remember when there were silver dollars. I mean, real silver dollars. Now we got this sandwich stuff that's made of metals that aren't worth as much as silver. I remember my dad back in, this says 1971, Nixon announced federal government would no longer redeem currency. Now, we read prophecy back in 1960s, too. And we realized that somebody's going to be getting your money and the system's going to fall apart. And so my dad, being wise prophecy student that he was, began saving those silver dollars and silver 50-cent pieces and all that type of thing in a can that he kept in the freezer. So, you take away my cash, will you? I got silver. There's also a scripture that says you're going to throw your gold and silver in the street. So, we'd have a lot to toss around, I guess, when time came. But so Dad was, saving silver because this is a smart thing to do. It was in the freezer, and I know on occasion a hungry teenager would want to get an ice cream, so on occasion I'd buy $14 ice cream cones. But anyway, shouldn't have done, I know that. But I think that can of silver got stolen along with his guns and a bunch of other stuff in Pasadena several years ago. So even that was gone. We didn't even have to throw it in the streets. And it wouldn't have saved us anyway. It'd be nice to have, but what are they worth? $13, $14 a piece now for those silvers. But at any rate, that didn't save us. But here, you can't get silver with currency anymore in 1971. That was the last vestige of a dollar tied to hard metal standard in America. From then on, the dollar was just a piece of paper that relied solely on the confidence of people who used it to conduct commerce. Why is this paper worth something? Because we say it is. Here's a $100 bill, and that's worth something because the government says, well, it is worth something. Now, go on. Another major development in the way people conducted commerce came about in the 1960s with the widespread introduction of the credit card. Now, those of us that graduated in the 60s and 70s remember that when you get out of college, you get all these letters from these wonderful banks that are telling you, here's your credit card, and you can spend it on whatever you want. I was a college student. I frankly didn't have a lot of money left over. I actually didn't have a debt. I graduated without a college debt, but I had an old car that my dad gave me, and that was pretty much it. But I had a credit card. And if my dad hadn't have taught me better, I could have been way deep in debt real early on. My wife and I, neither one, were great credit fans, but a lot of people were. And this started off, and people said, cool, I can go out and buy something that I can't afford. You got a new place, you got to have furniture. don't have the money. Put it on a credit card. It only costs you so much a month. Now, my wife and I, we had both graduated from college, and we had boxes of books. And so you line two boxes of books, two boxes on top of that, and two in front of that, put a quilt over it, it makes a neat couch. Didn't cost us anything. We had the books, we had the boxes, and we had the quilt. But anyway, everybody didn't do it that way. But the way the country was is that that became the thing to do. You didn't even need paper. You didn't need gold. You didn't need a cow. Just a piece of plastic. Coupled with the development of computer technology, a decade later, currency began to be replaced in monetary transactions with electronic debits and credits. By the 1970s, there was already talk of a cashless society, though few could really imagine it. Now, those of you that weren't raised in that period of time find it difficult to imagine it not being, having the cash, the credit card, or the electronic way of doing things. At that time, people talk about a cashless society. Not me. My dad didn't get his first credit card until the late 1980s sometime. He finally got a credit card because he wanted to rent a car. They wouldn't let him do it without a credit card. He was, no way they're going to get me to use the credit card. I pay cash for everything, which is a good thing to do, but he finally had to get a credit card. Today, it's inevitable. Worse yet, for freedom-loving working Americans, the sanctity of national sovereignty is simultaneously breaking down. We, as a nation, we're the greatest nation on earth, we're the most powerful, we're the strongest economic power, strongest military power. Nothing can bring us down, right? So now it says, he says, the European Union's common currency strongly suggests a growing trend towards regionalization and eventual globalization of monetary policy and standards. Let me read that again. The European Union's common currency strongly suggests a growing trend towards regionalization and eventual globalization of monetary policy and standards. There was globalization of monetary policy and standards, but there being somebody that controls all of this. Because how do you have a common standard unless somebody's controlling that standard? Otherwise, it's not common. He goes on to say it will take us just a few more crises to bring us to the nightmare reality of the closed, cashless, global economic system of total control. A closed, cashless economic system of total control. So things are being bought and sold without cash, without gold, without silver, without cows. A few more crises like the one we're currently experiencing in the U.S. financial system. Today, Americans can't work without a Social Security number. They can't open a bank account without one. It is used as the most common form of identification for Americans by government as well as the private sector. Yet when it was introduced, and right through the period which I received my first Social Security card in the 1960s, it clearly stated it could not be used for identification purposes. But now you can't do anything without it. You see how things have changed. And now it's been accepted. What else do you do? Back in Reno, the mid-80s, I put my wife's and my Social Security on our checks to make it easier for them to process. That's not a very smart thing to do. Don't have that anymore. If people steal your Social Security number and all that type of thing. Anyway. Now today we have smart cards that contain all kinds of useful data about people. The next phase of the plot to take away our privacy and our liberty will be widespread use of the RFID chips. Any of you ever use RFID chips? Yes, you do. Anybody shop at Ross? One of these other department stores that when you buy a piece of clothes, that if they don't like negate the RFID chip, then you walk out the door and it goes beep, beep, beep. Okay, it's a little RFID chip. It identifies that piece of clothing and knows whether whether you bought it and when you bought it, and helps with inventory and all kinds of stuff. Any of you get a recent passport? I did. We just got ours renewed. It says, be careful, how you handle it and things, because it's got a little RFID chip, radio frequency identification chip, that when this time we go through the airports and when we go to Guatemala, we'll run that through, and it'll automatically bring up all of the information about who we are, where we've been, how long we stayed, all of this stuff. So it's there. When my brother-in-law visited last Thanksgiving, he rented a Nissan Altima. And in the key, this little RFID chip identified that key as belonging to this car, and you just put it in your pocket, and you walk up to the car, and it automatically unlocks it. And you sit down in the car, and you push a button, because you don't need the key to turn it, because it identified you. And when you get out, it locks it for you. See, these are radio frequency ID chips. Even the cards in the hotel, that's not an RFID particularly, but it's got the information on the swipe card. And I was told by somebody a while back that when you stay at a hotel and they give you your key, you take that key with you, you don't turn it back in, because it's got a lot of your financial information on that card that you use to come and go in your room. And people take those cards and they use that to steal identity and stuff. So radio frequency identification chips are all over the place, and they're getting more common. He says you don't need to swipe your card anymore. A silicon chip inside goes off a radio frequency that can be detected even if it's in your pocket. Talk about convenience. And why it is convenient. He says, I predict the day is coming that all of us will be encouraged to accept the implantation of chips like this once. We'll no longer have to carry credit cards, driver's licenses, keys to start your car, even and your locks, open your locks at home. This isn't science fiction, it's science fact. And all that holds us back from use is the next crisis. I'm not here to prophesy that an RFID is 666 and the thing that's planted in your right hand or your forehead, but could it be? Sure. Could it be used to have the type of control that's being talked about in Revelation 13? Yeah, very easily. I'm not here to tell you it would be a sin to have an RFID. I would love to have one, frankly, to where if I had that maybe embedded in my hand, and I wouldn't go up to the house, and it's there, and the door opens automatically, and the car opens, and I don't have to give them my driver's license. I just, give them my hand, not a finger. You don't want to put your finger, but give them your hand, and it opens things up and causes things to happen. My bank account's accessed, my credit card. Wouldn't it be handy? I mean, it really would. Now, if you're think, well, this is the mark of the beast and you're sinning if you have it. I don't think it'd be sinning to have it, but what could happen from it? A little speculation here. Maybe some of you have some ideas on that too, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes if you'd like. So all that holds us back from them strongly encouraging you to accept an implanted ID chip is the next crisis. Then, the next phase, of course, would be mandatory implementation of chips. So you'll no longer be permitted to buy or sell privately. The government will have a record of every purchase transaction. Couldn't it happen? Yeah, it could. I firmly believe that it could. well, this is a U.S., you know, fun-loving United States, and we're independent. Nobody's going to get me to do anything like that. Well, if you don't want to buy or sell anything, you don't have to. I had a speculation that it's probably not right, because my prophecies are quite less than accurate oftentimes. But just think about a scenario, though. What if this whole crisis, you know, has developed here in this country, and we're $700 billion in debt with this thing, and then we've got our $3 trillion debt over the last 4 years, and in addition to that, and we've got all this, and who's going to pay for it all? Well, we've all got to chip in. Now, what if they just said, okay, now everybody's going to have to start working off this debt, so what we'll decide is that every Saturday, you have to go in and you have to donate your time at work. And that's you helping out the whole government, the whole system. And so you go in, you donate your time at work every Saturday. Well, you didn't go in. And your chip didn't pass through there, and it shows, well, this person didn't work Saturday. Well, I'm sorry, but you got to chip in for the good of the system, or else, sorry, we can't allow you to buy groceries. So you have to. What if it's probably not the scenario, but you think about how something could happen where you'd have, you know, your chip shows you didn't work, or you did work, and you didn't, and then you go to buy groceries, and the clerk says, I'm sorry, but your chip is no good because you didn't work Saturday. Could happen. I was watching something on TV the other day talking about France. And they said, France isn't in the type of economic situation that we are right now because, for one thing, they don't own homes like we do in this country now because everybody was able to buy a home for nothing and so forth. But so they don't own as many homes, and they also don't allow you to spend and to get into a whole lot of debt. Their credit cards are more like bank cards. You go in and you want to buy a 42-inch TV, and you swipe your card, and it'll go to connect with your bank, and it'll show the store, well, you don't have $789 or francs or whatever it is. All you've got is $600. So I'm sorry, you can't buy this TV. And so there's already a system there, which is a better system in a way than what we've got from what we have ended up doing with the debt that we've got in our nation. He goes on to say, do you want to understand how and why you just spent $700 billion and probably a lot more bailing out financial institutions? Do you want to know how this took place with very little debate or controversy? You must understand where we are headed and who is taking us there. Americans have lost control of their own destiny. Elections don't mean much. Congressional debates are illusory. We're on a path to tyranny. Neither Barack Obama nor John McCain are going to stop it. Neither Republican Congress or Democratic Congress is likely to slow it down. Most Americans seemed ill-equipped to understand what's happening or to comprehend the forces at work behind it. It's kind of my contention to begin with. I have a hard time envisioning things as they are and the depth to which it goes. And when you hear economists talk, there's a fear. I read Business Weekly yesterday, and most of the article, the whole thing was on what they call the economic ice age. And almost all of the articles used the word fear in there. It's really interesting that bankers fear, economists fear. The people fear. A lot of fear going on out there, and for a reason. It says they seem more concerned with their basic needs and material pleasures than the fact they're losing their birthright of self-government and individual freedom, that their children never experience the promises of the Constitution. And people are concerned with me. They can see why we are. But what's happening? They say, well, the government, I was listening to a radio show the other day, and a guy called up and said, yeah, the government really screwed us over. I said, well, how do you mean? Well, you know, they led us to believe that I could buy this house that's worth more than I can pay, and so they're at fault for me getting myself in debt. Really? Is it somebody else's fault? Now, they might have helped. He says, what just happened? To simplify it, the government just got bigger and more powerful, which means another nail was just hammered into the coffin of American liberty, in the coffin of American liberty. And in one of the largest wealth transfer schemes in history, a few wealthy, powerful individuals just got wealthier and more powerful at your expense. But this is not the end. This is not the final fix. This is not the final solution. Not by a long shot. There will be more consolidations of power and money. There will be more reforms. There will be more regulations, more restrictions on the way you conduct your affairs, more centralization, and more control. If you watched the debate the other night, even when Biden and Palin were duking it out a bit, Biden was saying, you know, you guys were against control. You guys were against regulation. See how wrong you were? We got to get things more regulated. We've got to take more control. This guy says, 30 years ago, I recall thinking how a prophecy in the Bible seemed a little far-fetched, something like science fiction fantasy. Today, we can see the handwriting on the wall. Some will ridicule me for stating it so bluntly. I don't care. We're a lot closer to Revelation 13, 16 to 17 than we were a week ago. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark on their right hand or in their foreheads that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. There are a lot of people talking about this, a lot of articles written, a lot of television shows, a lot of talk shows that are discussing the ramifications of this economic crisis that's going on right now. Read one article by the German finance minister, and he said, we got to get these Americans in control. They're out of control. And he made a statement that says, from this point, nothing will be the same as far as the economic system, as far as the world. He said 2008 will be the year that changes everything. Business Week had a number of, say, that was their focus this week, is on this economic crisis, world crisis. One of the articles was on the European banking system. Now, I didn't go into details on who the beast was and that type of thing, but our common understanding is that it comes from the Roman Empire that was controlled by the papacy and so forth, and that the Germans play a great role in this great empire. And then the European system and the 12 nations uniting, we feel, are from Europe, and that they will be that system that is the beast power. And there'll be a person who is over that and a person who is working with him in a religious section over that. I'll just take a couple of small quotes from some of these articles. This one on the European banking system says, one of the criticisms of the Eurozone financial architecture is that the European Central Bank does not have a lender of last resort responsibility and a clear mandate to deal with troubled financial institutions. Their bailout programs are coming from the nations themselves, but they don't have a central system like our central system does in the United States, which can hopefully bail us out. And they're looking at that and saying, maybe something needs to change here. He says, in the absence of such powers as a central financial institution that could help with bailouts and crises such as this, in the absence of such powers, governments have stepped in, but observers think that these events underline the urgency of giving the European Central Bank the needed firepower to act decisively. I think we've made a mistake here by not having a more centralized power, they're saying in Europe. Richard Ports, professor of economics at London Business School, says, I believe this should be a signpost for the future. They should waste no time in giving the European Central Bank enhanced authority. Of course, this could be done, one of the fortunate consequences of this situation. The fortunate consequence of this global crisis is that more power is given to Central European financial institution. Interesting, if not prophetic. We talk about the reasons for all of this, and again, what does it have to do with you and I and our situation today, you as an individual, we as a church? I think the most important thing is that these things are all going to happen that are prophesied, and the only real bailout is God. You know, he's the only real deliverance. So when we talk about all of the things that can and will happen, you know, our faith and trust in God, serve God, not mammon, is the answer to things. But there's, again, wisdom that I think we need to have regarding things. One of the articles in Business Week was talking about the need for businesses to cut back, because there aren't loans going to businesses, and of course people aren't coming in and buying stuff. And this guy works with high-end outlets such as Nordstrom's. And even Nordstrom's, where the wealthy people aren't shopping as much as they did, they're in trouble. And this guy goes through these Nordstrom stores and talks about what they need to do to keep solvent and in business. And I want to read this from that guy. He says, now he's preparing for the worst. And this is a quote from him. He says, we always do scenario planning, but not to the degree we are doing now. This guy is actually from the Estee Lauder Corporation here. He says he's asking each branch manager or brand manager at New York cosmetics giant three questions. What must you have? What would you like to keep going? And what can you give up? Those are three pretty good questions that I suggest that each of us would ask ourselves on a personal basis and with our family, whoever you are, whatever your circumstance is. If you're retired, if you're young and active, if you're nearing retirement or whatever, is ask the question, what must you have? What would you like to keep going, and what can you give up? Remember the presidential debates, back with both the presidential debates recently and the vice presidential debates this week, the question was asked, due to the economic crisis at hand and the $700 billion bailout and the fact that we just don't have the money anymore and we're going to be in debt as a nation even more than we are already, what will you give up when you become president or vice president? I don't know. Can't think of nothing. You know, they wouldn't answer that question, because they're not willing to give up anything, but they will be forced to give up things. It was a bad situation for them, because if they say what they'll give up, people say, oh, well, that'll cut into me, and I don't want to give that up. I'm going to vote for the other guy, because he promises that he's going to give me all the stuff that he's promising me. And whoever is elected, no matter what their promise, they're not going to be able to deliver. They can't. It's impossible. And so that is going to lessen the trust in those people in the government, and it's not going to help at all. Another article in Business Week was entitled, Shared Sacrifice Will Ease the Credit Crunch. He was talking about sacrifice. It's not something this country's ready for. Joe Biden said paying taxes is a what I call patriotic. And I heard Palin say, "That's not patriotic. You know, step up to the plate." I mean, we're being taxed to death. I'm not for taxes. I'd rather not pay any more than I have to either. But nobody's willing to give anything up. The government's not. People aren't. They want to be bailed out. You know, the people making wooden arrows for wooden toy arrows, you know, have to have their however many millions of dollars it is in this bailout program to save the world. But he talks about sacrifice. And again, I think there are some things here that we individually need to do as we not save ourselves, but hopefully put ourselves in a better position than we might be right now. Anything we can do, it can't hurt to be wise. And again, in the end, it won't save us, but we should be doing something. This article says, is the U.S. heading for another Great Depression? He said, probably not, but we're about to go through a period future generations may call the Great Repudiation. The root cause of today's crisis lies not in the housing market, but in America's foreign debt. Over the past 4 years, the U.S. private sector has borrowed an astonishing $3 trillion from the rest of the world. Money you can't afford. You know, the college student who gets his credit card when he gets right out of college and says, well, I got a $20,000 college debt, and I got the apartment with my live-in or my wife or, you know, whatever the circumstance is, but I got a credit card, and so I got new furniture, and I got a new stereo, and I got these things. Now, I can't pay for it, but it's on credit. I got all this debt, but I just need to know how much a month I can put out. I don't have to know how much I owe. The nation has done the same thing. We have bought stuff from Germany. We bought stuff from China. We bought stuff from all over the world. And, well, we really can't afford it. But if you give it to us, and we'll give you some money that we don't have. We're in debt. The money, directly and indirectly, came from countries such as China, Germany, Japan, Saudi Arabia, which ran huge trade surpluses with America. Foreign investors trusted their funds to U.S. financial institutions, which used much of the money for mortgage loans. So, you know, we've got, you know, we wanted to trade, say, for a cow, and we didn't have grain, but I'll give you these dollars for your cow or for your grain. Okay, well, I want a cow. Okay, so I don't have the grain to give to you for the cow, but I've got these dollars I'll give to you for the cow, and so they give you the cow. You give them the dollars, and then if they go to cash it in, the bank says, all right, we don't have the money to back that currency up. Or you write a check, probably be a better deal. You write a check for that cow, and then they go to cash the check, and there's no money in the bank for the check. So they're out. You owe them, and you can't pay. That's basically the way the situation is right now in this nation. American families took on a lot more debt than they could comfortably afford. Now no one is sure how much of that towering sum the U.S. is going to pay back, and all the uncertainty is rolling the financial markets. You know, people just got themselves in. It's like, and you may have been, I say the victim of this, but it's the victim of our own greed. And again, I don't know your personal financial situation, so if I'm stepping on toes here, that's tough, because everybody is messed up. That's why we're in the situation we are. And if you've been doing well with what God's given you, then good, keep up the good work. But if you ever go into a car dealership and you need some basic transportation, and you go in and you want a Chevy Aveo, even have a particularly good reputation, but it's cheap. And the guy says, man, Aveo, you know, that's a piece of garbage, you know, and I said, it's small. You know, I could get you into an Impala. How much can you afford a month? Well, you know, I only wanted to spend $12,000. But how much can you afford a month? You know, I can get you this $25,000 car for the same amount a month as you would have paid for that. Except for, you know, exponentially the amount of interest that you'd be paying on this, which we don't talk about. And so you say, yeah, well, for that amount a month, well, I can do that. And so now you're $25,000 in debt instead of only $12,000 in debt. But you got talked into it by this car salesman that wanted to make his commission. Well, people did that with houses. Well, you, an American dream, you deserve to have this house even though you can't afford it. And chances are, you know, things are going up so much that in 6 months you'd be able to double your money anyway, and it's a great investment. And people believe that. And now look what happened. The house isn't worth anything, worth nothing. You're awfully in debt. That's the way the nation is. So everybody is to blame, if you want to talk about blame. So the Washington bailout debate boils down to this question: who's going to bear the burden of the $3 trillion mistake? He calls it a mistake. Will low and middle income borrowers have to cut back on spending to pay their mortgage bills? No, I don't want to cut back on spending because that means I'd have to go without the 42-inch TV that I want. I'd like to have one, by the way, which I don't. So that's why I use the 42-inch TV thing, because that's on my mind. But people aren't willing to cut back. They want it. Well, they better bail me out. Will taxpayers have to chip in big bucks to pay defaults on those debts? Or will Washington act in a way that imposes large losses on foreign investors, in effect repudiating some of the debt? Well, they invested, and it's their fault they were stupid enough to invest. And so we'll let them take the blame and the brunt of it. The best outcome is shared sacrifice among borrowers, taxpayers, and foreign investors. But that result may be politically difficult to achieve. Because the president's candidates, they don't want to imply that you better cut back, you better do without things. Well, you're already doing without because of the gas prices and the, you know, everything else. So we expect me to cut back? No way. The big fat cats got rich off of these schemes. I ain't cutting back nothing. And there's this attitude that we deserve it. There's a generation that grew up deserving these things. It's the American dream. Got to have everything now. How many have fallen into that trap? It's become a way of life. And the whole point of this whole thing, the financial crisis, is we messed up big time by not following some basic biblical principles. As individuals, as a nation, you know, God's got a principle. For example, you know, there are people that they take a vacation, they go on a cruise, well, but just put it on the credit card. They'll pay for it later. You know, the Feast of Tabernacles isn't a vacation, but it's our vacation time, and we combine it and things. But he says, no, you save a tithe. So you've got the money to take it and go. That's a biblical principle, is saving for what you want to buy. But we've gotten in excessive debt. What was it back in the... I'll probably revisit this after the feast sometime and talk a little bit more about some of those things. But this guy says of that $3 trillion in debt recently, at least a third of the debt, perhaps a half, was financed with foreign money. As a result, foreign investors are sitting on an enormous mountain of mortgage-related securities. To make good on their mortgages, how many middle-income families would have to sharply cut their spending, hurting both domestic economy and countries that export to the U.S.? So if you do cut back, then what's going to happen? Well, you're not buying the television. So you cut back to do the thing you ought to do. Well, you're not buying a television, then they're not able to make the television because they can't sell them, and so you have to lay off the person that makes the television. And so you've got people getting out of work one way or the other. There's a credit crisis going on right now where it's difficult for people to get loans for cars. So you go in and, you know, unless you got cash for a car or a big deposit down, can't get a car. You can't get a car, and the guy at General Motors showroom isn't selling it, and so he's out of work. I saw a statistic yesterday that said in order for showrooms to keep up the level of sales that they need to maintain, that they've had, that 3,600 car dealerships will have to go out of business this year in order for the ones that still exist to keep up their level of sales. So the General Motors guy's not making cars, and so they lay him off because, sorry, we don't have any work for you. And then he's not buying what it is that you produce or your service, and he's not paying taxes because he doesn't have money to pay taxes, and so the government now doesn't have the money, and you're a government employee. Well, I'm a government employee. I'm all right. Well, until there's not enough money in the system there, and then you're laid off, and then you're not buying something. And you say, oh, this whole thing, it's not a pretty sight. I'm simplifying things, I know, but and it's a very complicated situation, but the bottom line is that's what's happening. Now it says the global response to such a move depends a lot on how it's presented by the leaders in Washington. It's unseemly for the world's richest country to refuse to pay some of its debts. Ah, the Chinese can handle it. What do they live on? Well, most of them don't live very high. And it says, in the worst case, losses by foreign investors would lead to an unwillingness to invest in the U.S. while fueling anti-American sentiment around the world. I think you see where this is going. I'll just have one more quote. This one is on the credit crunch, and it's talking about how companies are finding it hard to get credit, and sometimes some companies borrow money to make payrolls, and so if they're not able to borrow the money to make payroll, can't pay you, sorry. Of course, you can't buy something which causes somebody else to not, and you get laid off. You can't make your mortgage payment. And then he's talking about the possibility, the probability of credit cards. Somebody told me that they had a credit card they hadn't used. It was being recalled. It says, tear it up, send it back. It said use of credit cards may be taken away, because people are putting something on a credit card to keep from having to pay for it, and then, well, what if you're laid off? Can you pay your credit? No, I'll have to default. I'll have to declare bankruptcy, and so you're not paying the bank back. And so this use of credit is very likely could go away. And just even the use of your credit card. He says that could be the next little thing that impacts individual consumers. He said, I don't have a sense of how quickly that could happen, but it could happen fairly soon. That plus more remote possibility of payroll checks stopping if companies rely on short-term credit from banks to meet payroll requirements start to get turned down, leaving consumers high and dry. He says, Lockwood doesn't believe that most consumers are even aware of the broader implications of the credit freeze or the reasons behind the legislative battle over a rescue plan. And his assessment is this, which I think is probably pretty true. He says they, the people, will respond to the failure of the rescue bill like they do to all other major financial and political initiatives, which is with long glazed stares. What just happened? You think about it. How many long glazed stares have you had if you invested in the dot-coms? Wow, cool. Make a lot of money. And then that little thing blew away. So what happened? You invested in the banks, and that went south. Now it's going south again. Or you invested in oil, like a lot of people did. Yeah, oil can only go higher. And then it went down, and if you had something in there, I don't know if any of you speculated that way, but a lot of people bought $151 oil that now has that, and hopefully it'll go back up so they can sell it without a loss. The stock market. Oh, man, I'm making so much money in the stock market, hand over fist. And how many times does that have to go under to... But I look at my little 401k things and all that, and it's pretty pathetic. Not a lot of good news out there. Retirement? But I'm retired. Oh, what if what if the bank that holds that or the insurance company that holds that goes under, the company folds, and that retirement's not there? You ever hear of Exxon? Or not Exxon, Enron? There are people that had great retirement programs with Enron, ended up without a dime. We are in a situation that should cause us to be very concerned about our personal situations. But yet, it's one of those things kind of like the trumpets. You know, it says that when the trumpets blow, that a lot of things will happen that are awful to this world. A lot of disasters, a lot of death, a lot of things going on that are not pleasant, but it must happen first before the return of Christ, when that last trumpet blows and Christ returns. So these are some of the things and the types of things we're going through that are kind of presage the return of Christ. So it's good and it's bad. Let me just read one scripture here. Deuteronomy 28, and in light of some of the things we've just been reading, I think this is interesting. Deuteronomy 28:43, and it's talking about Israel. It's talking about you obey, you're going to be blessed. If you turn your back on me, I'll leave you to your own. And Deuteronomy 28:43 says, foreigners living among you will become stronger and stronger, and you will become weaker and weaker. You know, and we can talk about the border situation. You know, with the other nations becoming stronger and stronger, we being weaker and weaker. We can talk about foreign investors becoming stronger and stronger, and we being weaker and weaker. It says, verse 44, they will lend money to you, but you will not lend it to them. Because you can't pay them back. They're not interested in you lending them money. They will be the head, and you will be the tail. Proverbs 22, verse 7 says, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Who's the lender? Got incredible debts. We can't even fathom trillions and what that means. Verse 45, if you refuse to listen to the Lord your God, to obey his commandments and the decrees he has given you, all these curses will pursue you and overtake you until you are destroyed. These horrors will serve as a sign and a warning among you and your descendants forever. Verse 47, if you do not serve the Lord your God with joy and enthusiasm for the abundant benefits you've received, you will serve your enemies whom the Lord will send against you. You'll be left hungry, thirsty, naked, and lacking in everything. The Lord will put an iron yoke on your neck, oppressing you harshly until he has destroyed you. That's the prophecies about the Israelitish nations of which we are. And those things are going to happen. And again, it's scary but exciting. You know, the sound of the trumpet brings terror and it brings relief. So I've said a number of things, and I'd like you to comment on some of those or add some things or even speculate about some things, if you let us know it's speculation. If something's been revealed to you, maybe we might want to be cautious with that. But what are some of your thoughts on some of this?